My name is Johannes Krupp. I'm coming from CISPA, and today I'm presenting our work on Tether, gnawing at Ethereum to automatically exploit smart contracts. This is joint work with my supervisor, Christian Rosso. So, in a nutshell, what are we trying to achieve? Well, in the recent years, we've seen lots of blockchain systems, and today we want to put ourselves in the shoes of the attacker and basically ask ourselves, how can we interact with those systems such that in the end, we get money? Because basically, as attackers, that's what we're interested in. And specifically, we're looking at Ethereum. Why Ethereum? Well, similar to other blockchain systems, in Ethereum, you have the concept of regular user accounts, which are governed by a private public key pair. And those user accounts can send transactions between them. However, unlike other blockchain systems, Ethereum also has the concept of so-called smart contracts. Smart contracts are basically small programs that can receive transactions and then handle outgoing transactions themselves. A smart contract is a small piece of Ethereum virtual machine bytecode and is executed on every incoming transaction. And otherwise, they really behave just like regular accounts. So they live at an address and they can keep their own balance. And they're used for cases like crowdfunding schemes where all the funders are basically getting back all their money if a certain amount is not reached, or for shared wallets where all transactions have to be approved by multiple parties, or even for things like games, mostly gambling. However, since smart contracts are written by humans, they may contain bugs, of course. And quite surprisingly, once deployed, smart contracts also cannot be updated, which gives us as an attacker a nice advantage, because now we basically have all the problems of software vulnerabilities in the realm of cryptocurrencies. And since we are systems people, we're not good with crypto, this gives us a nice attack vector, namely we can now find and exploit those bugs. So in the end, we basically want to send a transaction to a smart contract and get out money. So how do transactions look like? A transaction basically has five basic fields. So you have the from field, which is where the transaction is coming from, the transaction sender. You have the to field, where the transaction is headed to, the recipient. You have the value, which may also be zero in Ethereum. Then you have something called gas, which basically models the transaction fee that you're paying, which we will ignore for our case. And then you also have a field called data, which is an up to infinitely large array of bytes that usually serves as the input data to the smart contract. So how are smart contracts executed? I said before that a smart contract is a piece of Ethereum virtual machine bytecode. So let's have a look at the Ethereum virtual machine. The EVM is a basic stack machine using 256-bit words and has roughly 70 instructions, like you would expect, arithmetic instructions, logic instructions, control flow instructions, and specifically for Ethereum, also blockchain interaction instructions. Now, of course, the first challenge that we have to deal with when analyzing those smart contracts is they are just there in bytecode form. So the very first thing we have to do is basically get some sort of control flow graph out of it that we can analyze. And for this, we can have a look at the control flow instructions, because there are only very few of them, specifically three. There's the jump instruction that takes a single argument from the stack, which is the jump target. There's the jump I instruction that takes two arguments, which is a conditional jump. And then you also have this weird instruction, which is jump dest, which just marks a valid destination for a jump. So if you now look at a sequence of bytes as they come from a smart contract, the first thing we can do is just find all the jump instructions, because we definitely know that a basic block will always end in a jump. Second, we can also look at jump I instructions, because basic blocks will also end at jump I. And then finally, since jump dest marks the valid begin of a new basic block, we also know those. So we can now split all our bytes into basic blocks and then try to disassemble those, and we'll end up with a bunch of basic blocks. Next question, of course, is how are those blocks connected? And, well, there are some easy cases. So, for example, jump I definitely, since it's a conditional jump, has a fall through. So we can always add this edge. There are also other easy cases where, for example, the jump I is preceded by a push instruction. And in this case, we know exactly what's on top of the stack and where the jump will go to. So we can also add those. And then there are also hard cases. So for example, for this jump instruction, it's not immediately obvious where this jump will go. But what we can do in this case is basically a backwards taint analysis, we will just say, okay, at the point of this jump, the stack must look something like this. At the previous instruction, well, there's a jump test, it's basically a no-op, nothing happened there. Before we had a jump I instruction, we know a jump I takes two stack arguments, so there must be two more before. Before this was a push 7, so the top one was a 7. Before this was a call value, which pushes the value of the current call on top of the stack. And before this was a 9. So now we know that our tainted argument must have been 9, and we can add another edge in our control flow graph. So now we solve the control flow graph recovery problem. But of course, what we're really interested in is how can we get money from the contract? And as I said before, there's the specific case of all those blockchain interaction instructions. And we can have a closer look at those. Specifically, we identified four critical instructions. So the first one that's obvious is the call instruction. The call instruction will generate a new transaction. And it basically takes two arguments, the address and the value. So if we as an attacker can execute a call instruction while we're in control of two and value, we can transfer money to ourselves. The second critical instruction we identified is self-destruct. This instruction is the only update mechanism, in quotes, if you want to, because the only thing you can do with a smart contract is you can destroy it. And self-destruct also takes a single argument, which is basically the address, where all the remaining funds, which are still in the contract, will be transferred to. Meaning that if SV as an attacker can execute a self-destruct instruction, we can get all the remaining money that's in the contract. And these are basically the only two instructions that can transfer value in Ethereum. There are two more instructions we have to care about, namely call code and delegate call, which are used to reuse code of other contracts. So if we can execute either of those while being in control of the top stack argument, we can basically perform code injection attacks and then execute either of the first two. What this boils down to, however, is that we must always execute one of those four. We have very specifically defined points of exploit. And this allows us to define the notion of critical path. So to identify a critical path, we just look in our control flow graph for one of those instructions we identified, and then compute the backward slices of those. Basically, we can then filter for ones where the attacker is in control, because it could be that if we take this branch, then that the top stack argument is coming from our input data, which we are in control of. But it could be that in this other branch, the argument is always 0, and we're not really interested in those. So we can prune those, then generate a path, and from there on, we basically just use symbolic execution to find out which are the path constraints, and then use a constraint server. If it's unsatisfiable, we'll just try the next path. If it's satisfiable, well, we now have a set of matching inputs for our transaction. There are, however, two more slight challenges that make this non-straightforward. Namely, contracts may have state, and there's also the odd case of the SHA-3 instruction. So take, for example, a look at this contract. This is now the high-level Solidity form. This contract basically defines a single Boolean variable vulnerable, which is initially set to false. And there's a function exploit, which transfers all the money to the attacker, but it requires vulnerable to be true. And there's also a second function, make vulnerable, which will set this to true. However, a function call corresponds to transaction. So if you want to exploit this, we need at least two transactions. And, well, since we're dealing with low-level bytecode anyways, the question that we're really interested in is, how is this implemented at the bytecode level? And for this, we can take a look at the memory model. So the EVM basically has three ranges of memory. We have the stack, which is a stack of 256-bit words. Then we also have what's called the memory, which is basically an array, which is byte addressable. And finally, we have the storage, which implements a map or dictionary structure. And as it turns out, both the stack and the memory are volatile and will always be initialized to zeros in the beginning of execution. The only thing that is persistent is the storage, which means that any state change we observe must equal to a storage change. And luckily, there are only two instructions that are interacting with the storage. There's sload, which loads a value for a key, and there's sstore, which stores a value for a key. So similar to the notion of our critical paths, we can now define the notion of state-changing paths. And for this, we just locate sstore instructions, compute those backward slices, generate paths, and then execute those symbolically to A, collect all the path constraints, x mod equals 0 in this case, and also all the addresses which are read or written by the path. And now, to form our final exploit, we basically can take the state-changing path and a critical path that we found and combine those two. So to combine the set of constraints, we basically just take the union. The only thing we have to do is we have to do a bit of alpha renaming such that variables are still scoped to their specific execution. For the set of reads, we basically take the set of reads of the second transaction, remove the writes of the first, and append the reads of the first transaction. In this case, we have the empty set. And the set of writes is just the union of the set of writes of both. And then, of course, we cannot only do this for one state-changing transaction, but we can chain multiple state-changing transactions before a critical transaction. And with this, we basically solve the problem of contract state, which still leaves the SHA-3 instruction. Ethereum has this one specific instruction which is used to compute a hash. It takes two inputs, an offset into the memory and a length, and it's used to implement Solidity's mapping type, for example. Now, for historic reasons, it does not exactly compute SHA-3, but rather Kerchak-256, but is still the same. So, for example, if we have a function like this, the function check, that takes a data and a check value as input, and then requires that data is equal to the string 1337, and that the SHA-3 of the data is equal to check. So we'll end up with those two constraints. And the big question now is, how actually can we solve the constraint SHA-3 of data equal check? Because I think it's rather obvious that we cannot just put this to a constraint solver. If a constraint solver could reverse the hash, then, well, the hash would be no good at all. So what we can define is so-called dependent expressions and dependent constraints. So now we see here that both constraints depend on data. Specifically, SHA-3 of data is an expression which depends on something else. So we call this a dependent expression. And therefore, we can also say that this entire constraint is a dependent constraint. And we then develop an iterative algorithm which basically removes all dependent constraints, solves the reduced set of constraints, which we can now do because there are no more dependencies, and then from those concrete values which we now derived, computes the hash values. So if we know that data is equal to 1337, we know that the hash of it must start with 985D. And now we can just replace all the dependent constraints we had with the concrete values we derived. And now we have independent constraint. And now we can just repeat the entire process, and this will resolve all the hash. And we just went forward and implemented all of those in our end-to-end tool called Tether, which basically does CFD recovery, critical instruction identification, path generation, constraint generation, path stitching, and exploit generation, and takes as input the bytecode form of the smart contract and outputs a set of transactions which will exploit this. Now, of course, this is a high claim, so we did some evaluation. What we did is we tried to extract all the contracts we could from the Ethereum blockchain. And from our snapshot, we extracted about 780,000 contracts. And, to give ourselves a bit of relief, we just looked at the unique contracts. Because it turns out that while there are many contracts out there, the number of unique source codes is rather small, only roughly 40,000. And then we just analyzed those. We allowed 30 minutes for the CFG recovery and then 30 minutes for the exploit generation. And it turns out that for the vast majority of all four cases which we considered, there is no critical path in the contract, meaning that there's no way one could exploit those. Then for 70% in the case of call and 5% in the case of self-destructs, there are cases where there is a critical path, but the constraints are not satisfiable, meaning that we are pretty sure that those cannot be exploited, although we might miss something. And finally, there are also exploits. In number of percentages, it's rather low, but at least it's 1.4-something percentages for call and almost 1% for self-destruct. And then, of course, there have also been cases of a timeout where either the CFG reconstruction did not finish in time or the exploit generation did not. Now, looking closer at those exploits, we actually generated 426 call exploits, 2 call code exploits, 8 delegate call exploits, and 220 self-destruct exploits. And in addition, we also have 121 potential exploits for call and 78 potential exploits for self-destruct. And by potential exploit, we just mean that those are still dependent on other stuff in the chain. So for example, those could work, but only if another contract does something else in the blockchain. And those we couldn't verify. So overall, we have 630 unique exploits targeting 1,731 contracts for a total of 1,769 total exploits, meaning that multiple exploits work against multiple contracts, and some contracts also have multiple exploits against them. So to validate this, well, of course, you could just go to the actual Ethereum blockchain and start exploiting actual contracts, but there might be some ethical concerns. So instead, we set up our local test network and with 3 accounts, namely the target contract, an attacker account, and a shellcode account that we could use in call code and delegate call exploits. And from there on, it's basically a 2-step process. The first thing we have to do is we have to update the exploit we found previously to reflect the storage content of the actual storage. And then we just replay the exploit. And this works surprisingly well. So for example, for almost 90% of our call exploits, they just work as is. For call code, well, it's just a half, but there's only just one and the other one fails. And for delegate call and self-destructs, it's similar high percentage numbers. There are some for which the updating step fails. So there is where our assumption that the initial storage is empty is invalid. And there are also some where the exploit just does not work for reasons we did not further go into. So with that many exploits, of course, another question that naturally comes up is, what are the actual vulnerabilities to this behind this? To find out this, well, you could reverse engineer all those, but since we're talking about 40,000 different contracts, this is rather infeasible. The problem is, however, that source code is generally unavailable for those. Except it's not really, because we could use some open source intelligence, for example, the publish and verify feature on etherscan.io, where people can basically upload their own contract source code and have them verify that it matches the bytecode stored in the blockchain. And, well, for all our 1,000 contracts that are vulnerable, we actually found that there are 44 for which we have source code, which might not seem like much, but, well, we can still manually analyze those. It's not representative, but it might give us some insight. So what are the flaws we found? Well, the first one is old classical logic bugs. So, for example, this here is the modifier that's used in many contracts called onlyOwner. It basically requires that the message sender is equal to the stored owner and only will then execute the code further. However, we also found an implementation that looks like this, meaning this can be executed by anyone but the owner. And, well, we believe this is a logic error. Well, then there are also cases of what we call semantic confusion. So, for example, inside a execution, you have message.value, which corresponds to the value of the current transaction. And you have this.balance, which corresponds to the entire balance of the contract. If you're refunding people, don't confuse the two. And then, well, for the third task is what we call visibility errors. So, for example, assume we have a contract that's implementing some bet, and it has a play function. And whenever bet of one is equal, greater than bet two, we will call win with player one. If it's the other way around, we will call win with player two. And if they are both equal, we call a draw function. And those functions could be implemented something like this. So function win just transfers the win amount to the winner. Function draw just transfers the draw amount to both. The critical point here is that there's this internal keyword which marks a function as being callable only by other functions in the same contract. And we can see that it's missing here for draw. And the default visibility is public, which means that we as an attacker can just call draw attacker attacker, and we will get free money twice. And then for a fourth class, we also have what we call constructor errors. So for example, we have a contract named owned, which also has a function owned. And since they're named the same, it becomes the constructor, meaning this function is executed only once at contract creation, and the message sender is the contract creator. A slight variant of this, where now the function is named owned but lowercase, makes this function not a constructor anymore. It's now a regular function. It can be called by anyone, and anyone can be the message sender, and therefore take ownership of the contract. And, well, this means that basically three out of the four classes we see are specific to Solidity and may be caused by the syntax choices of Solidity. So, to conclude our work, we basically defined the notion of critical paths, built an end-to-end tool called Tether to generate exploits from binary representation of Ethereum smart contracts. We did a validation finding several thousand exploits, and also looked that most of those might be caused by Solidity. My name is Johannes Krupp. I now have an email and apparently since a few days also a Twitter handle, and Tether will be open sourced in half a year. Thank you very much.
All right, we have time for two or three questions.
Hi, Shou Chen from Microsoft Research. This is really cool work and very good presentation. I have two questions. Mm-hmm. First is, can you tell a little bit about your exploit generation strategy? That is typically, that will involve a lot of things, like sometimes you even need a malicious contract to be constructed, not only the caller, but some...
Not really. So since we defined those four entry points for an exploit, those four instructions, mm-hmm. we basically end up just with a set of path constraints for some state-changing transactions and then a set of path constraints for the critical transaction. Uh-huh. And we just have to resolve those to find the corresponding inputs to our transactions.
Okay. Like
the only thing we can interact with the contract is by transactions. And the only thing we can control there is the input data and maybe the value.
Okay. So because in this space, everybody seems to talk about the well-known DAO attack. Right? In mm-hmm. that case, if you want to synthesize an end-to-end attack, you need yes. to be so intelligent that you come up with the re-entrancy pattern.
Yes. Okay. So, this is a different case. I should probably be clear about this. Right? There are different attacks on Ethereum. We're not doing re-entrancy. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Great. Great. Second question is, do you know if this 44 vulnerable contract actually hold money? Because I'm asking the question because it's hard to imagine that the bug that that does access control for everybody but the owner, mm-hmm. that is not even functional, right?
Yep. So for those that for which we have source code, we did not specifically look at this. However, I know that at least one of the contracts we were able to exploit at some point held 5,000 Ether, I believe.
Oh, okay. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Inge from John Hopkins. Very nice, solid work. I really like it. So, a question about like what type of vulnerabilities is Tether like able to handle? Like, can you handle, I think, like re-entry is not in scope? How about like underflow, overflow? Can you give like
It's a good question. So re-entrancy, basically, we cannot handle. All the exploits that we can handle is where you just send a fixed number of transactions from a regular account to a contract account. So with this, we can handle buffer overflow, integer overflows, for example, and logic errors. But for re-entrancy, you have to have this interaction between the attacking contract and the exploited contract. Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot. Let's thank Johannes one more time.